the victims are suffering injuries. But the problem is, we're talking about fraud in many cases. These are not visible injuries. Every much as devastating in some cases as a violent crime.
You're listening to Chuck Cohen, a retired captain with the Indiana State Police, a certified fraud examiner, and vice president of the NW3C. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Beyond the training that we give, where can that person start to work towards getting a cumulative ability to have that certification so they have that credibility professionally as they're talking with their colleagues and as they're talking with the supervisors and as they're talking with the court?
In this episode, we discuss the value of the National White Collar Crime Center, why the Certified Economic Crime Forensic Examiner credential exists, the emotional impact of fraud investigations on both the victim and the investigating agent, and how investigations on crimes against children is similar to fraud investigations. He is a vice president at the National White Collar Crime Center. He also speaks internationally on topics including online social networks and criminal investigations, cybercrime, online fraud, money laundering, and corruption. Chuck Cohen, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thank you, Robert. Great to be with you.
During the COVID time, I have spent more time on the NW3 website, which is the National White Collar Crime Center, and thought that you did an excellent job as a speaker. You did a couple courses. One was on proxy and one was on darknet that I think every investigator should be allowed to listen to. It was just very good, and I appreciate your tradecraft. I really do. Thank you so much for doing that for society.
Well, I appreciate you actually taking the time to watch it. It's nice when we do a webinar to know that people are finding of interest and hopefully finding us some value for as they do their investigations.
I have taken that information and using it in my line of work as well. What actually is NW3C?
Well, NW3C, the National White Collar Crime Center, was formed in 1978. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. Primary mission is provide training and technical assistance to state, local, tribal, and territorial police, regulators, prosecutors, and other criminal justice professionals. A significant amount of funding is through the Department of Justice, but also additional federal funding and other federal funding sources. Put it simply, we try the best in the areas around high-tech crime, economic crime, and criminal intelligence to help practitioners catch bad guys and keep people safe.
Does someone have to be a member of the organization to get your services, or is it open to the public? How does that work?
It's open to criminal justice practitioners. So under those activities that are funded through Department of Justice are available to state, local, tribal, and territorial law enforcement. When there's availability and bandwidth, we also try to provide the same kind of training for federal law enforcement and in the private sector, both in the United States and internationally. So for those classes that have a cap on them as far as the number of attendees because of technology, essentially they fill up with state and local investigators, so we aren't able to offer those in many cases to federal law enforcement unless there's a seat available. We don't want to ever turn away our primary audience that we're receiving the funding for, which is state and local investigators. But for things like webinars that you mentioned previously, because right now we can have up to 1,000 people live listening to one, in many cases we can also offer that training to federal investigators, to private sector investigators. Because what we find is if we can help provide information to investigators anywhere in the world or to private sector investigators, by extension, that meets our core mission, which is to provide information to help state and local investigators and prosecutors.
So in order to be a member of the White Collar Crime Center or to get membership into it, it's free as long as you are qualified in your law enforcement duties at this point in time.
That's exactly right. It's completely free. Most of our activities are completely funded by the Department of Justice. So as long as you meet that threshold, not just police, but also analysts in the public sector, government regulators, as well as for much of it, we can also offer to federal law enforcement, federal regulators, investigators in your full-time position, and also private sector investigators, those that work in places like banking, insurance industry, and elsewhere. Much of that funding is, again, to provide that training and then also technical assistance when it's needed in those areas of economic crime, high-tech crime, criminal intelligence. Understanding that when we can help those investigators anywhere, because as the technology behind crime evolves, as a tradecraft gets more sophisticated by offenders, we have to work collaboratively as a team to successfully complete those investigations.
You spent a lot of time with the Indiana State Police. I believe you actually retired as captain for 25 years. What compelled you to join NW3C?
It was a perfect fit for me when I retired from Indiana State Police to join NW3C, and I was very fortunate to be offered that leadership position with them, because for the better part of my career, well over 20 of those 25 years, I was a recipient, took advantage of and benefited from their services, from their training, as I was trying to be as good a investigator as I possibly could be and to understand emerging technologies and provide and those technical assistance roles as I encountered things in my investigations that I didn't understand that I needed assistance with. And then as I transitioned as a supervisor with Indiana State Police, to be able to offer that and work with NW3C to provide training where the price is right, meaning free for me as a police supervisor to the analysts I was responsible for, the forensic examiners I was responsible for, digital forensic examiners, as well as to the investigators. So having taken advantage of and worked so closely with those services of NW3C professionally in my law enforcement career, it was a perfect fit to then be able to try to give some back to current practitioners working with NW3C. And it was a great opportunity for me to be able to transition into a retirement position where at least in some small tangential way, I can still help those practitioners catch bad guys. I knew it was a place that I could be proud to work for.
So what are your duties now as vice president?
A lot of it's strategic, finding the best way that we can provide as much resources as possible to investigators, to criminal justice practitioners in the U.S. and elsewhere, making sure that our training, particularly in the high-tech crime area, is up to date. Apple, as an example, just this week released publicly iOS 14, the newest operating system for iPhones and iPads, making sure that on day one, we're providing those digital forensic examiners and investigators information about what forensic artifacts are being left behind as just one example, making sure that training we're providing is up to date, that it's accurate, that it's cutting edge, that even though it is free in many cases because it's being funded by the federal government, it is not just as good as, but hopefully better than any training they can get commercially that that department have to pay for. What I found is that's particularly important as tax revenue is decreasing because of challenges with COVID, as well as other challenges for police, as training budgets are dwindling, that we can help in an ever more important way to provide that technically sophisticated, specialized investigative training.
So regarding fraud investigations, you're assisting the state, locals, and tribal areas. Is there a database that a fraud investigator, or I'll just give an example. You have a patrol officer who's now turned sergeant. Now he's in charge of his white collar squad, and he's probably got two people there. He doesn't have an accounting background. I'm assuming he can go to your website and find something regarding that's fraud related that would help him become a better detective.
Absolutely. On the training side, we provide training in four different modalities. Classroom, which of course is put on hold at least through the end of this calendar year. On demand, which is available anytime he wants to get that economic crime or fraud related training. Generally, that is more basic training. It's designed to be anywhere between half an hour, maybe 4 hours in length. Even with that said, it has a pretest, has a post-test, has skills assessments. Assuming that that person passes the post-test after getting the training, it contains a certificate of attainment that goes with it, live online, hopefully as good or better an experience as in a classroom training, and also webinars by internal and external subject matter experts on various topics, many of them related to fraud and economic crime. So on the training side, those are all available to public sector regulators and investigators completely free. In addition, we have an investigative resources area that's available to vetted law enforcement regulators that has resources in the case of fraud, things as an example of a model policy for seizing cryptocurrency. Other guides about when your investigation, or your fraud investigation touches up against cryptocurrency. Law enforcement guides from over 60 different electronic service providers. So when part of that fraud scheme involves a website that is registered with a company like GoDaddy, what's GoDaddy's law enforcement policy? As well as templates for legal process, where those are subpoenas, court orders, search warrants, trying to register trap and trace orders. Basically, what we're trying to do is provide those resources. In many cases, we're talking about the federal law enforcement agencies like IRS criminal investigations, like FBI, like Secret Service. that do fraud investigations as a core part of the functionality. Within those federal law enforcement agencies, there are specialized components they can go to help get the training as they need that for a particular fraud investigation or get that technical support. What we're trying to do is provide, again, with federal funding for Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance, provide similar access to training and technical assistance for state and local investigators and regulators as they're doing their fraud investigations.
During a fraud investigation in particular, there are multiple credentials out there in this world that a forensic examiner or fraud investigator can get. I do believe that NW3C has at least a credential that they issue as well. Please tell me about that credential.
Okay, so we offer three credentials, three certifications for those that are qualified. The one that is most applicable to fraud investigators is Certified Economic Crime Forensic Examiner. And we do those on a point system, essentially having to accumulate at least 25 points based on a combination of education, training, and experience. We also offer a Certified Cybercrime Investigator and Certified Cybercrime Examiner. And I was sort of surprised to see a lot of fraud investigators are very much interested in that Certified Cybercrime Investigator certification. There are other fraud certificates that are available. Myself, I'm a Certified Fraud Examiner through ACFE. And I have been for well over a dozen years. But what we try to do with these certifications is specifically design them for public sector practitioners, for police, for public sector analysts, for public sector regulators, with them in mind first, as opposed to thinking of designing them for the private sector and then trying to make them accessible to the public. We kind of reverse that.
You're not really competing with the CFE per se. It's just your niche is these criminal investigators or regulators that this credential is offered to them based upon whatever training that you offer for through your websites or through your organization.
That's absolutely correct. We're not trying to compete. We're trying to complement. At the same time, if the question is, what's the value? One of the things of value besides professional demonstration of professionalism is understanding that those public sector investigators and regulators oftentimes are going to have to testify in court in criminal matters. I can remember doing a fraud investigation myself years ago where defense tried to argue because I didn't have any certifications, even though at the time I had an MBA, that I should not be allowed to testify about anything involving numbers because I wasn't a public accountant, because at the time I didn't have any professional certifications, even though I'd gone to specialized training, even though I at the time had an MBA from a accredited university, made the argument and almost won the argument that I should not be allowed to testify about anything involving numbers.
Right, just because you didn't have that certification that said fraud examiner or fraud investigator.
Because as a defense expert, he hired a CPA. And as I was explaining, not just whether or not I'd be qualified as an expert witness, but then as a fact witness, the argument was in a rural court in Indiana, where he almost won the argument, that I should not be allowed to introduce in evidence anything involving numbers.
That's all I can say is call that bizarre, especially from a white-collar investigator who's in a state or local law enforcement. I mean, this is what you do all day long is testify.
With those kind of circumstances in mind, that really is how we looked at that professional certification, looking to see what is available specifically for. And it was a very intentional process with certifications not to do the static skills test. I can tell you for some professional certifications I've had from others, I've had to answer those knowledge tests in a way that is completely different than what I do as a public sector investigator. I mean, I'm going to answer the question I know they want to answer, but that doesn't apply to how police, how detectives, how regulators are required to do their job. Things about collection of evidence, things about doing interviews. So we specifically made this in a way that whether someone is mid-career or later in their career, if they have that threshold of knowledge, education, experience, training, to be able to attain it where there is still a very credible certification from hopefully, we believe, and it's a credible organization providing the certification with an outside assessment that we contract with. So it's not us making the decision. It's someone else from the outside. But specifically with that detective in mind that may have that experience for 10 years as robbery homicide and now is the new lieutenant of, or maybe he's transitioning over into a fraud unit. Beyond the training that we give, where can that person start to work towards getting a cumulative ability to have that certification so they have that credibility professionally as they're talking with their colleagues and as they're talking with the supervisors and as they're talking with the court?
For that credential that we're talking about, in particular, I'm assuming there's a number of hours that they have to complete?
Correct. It's a point system. And if you go to the NW3C site, the chart of how to get that point system is there. We were actually very lucky that one federal law enforcement agency is working with us right now and is trying to get a number of their special agents from every field office in the United States to obtain one of the certifications and working through that with that federal law enforcement agency.
There is a niche for state and local tribal investigators to need the certification, and I'm glad you guys are feeling it. Before and after you joined NW3C, what certifications did you get to assist you in fraud investigations?
The one available that I did attain was a certified fraud examiner, the CFE certification, and that was helpful. And a large part of the reason why I chose to get that certification, and then once I became the supervisor of what we call organized crime corruption with the Indiana State Police, made that a requirement for others, was at the time that was the most closely related to what those investigators were doing professionally in their fraud investigations. And a large part of that was going back to the example I mentioned before of not just in that case, but others, having the court's question or being able to demonstrate to the court's competency and credibility, something beyond the various specifically related trainings, but that some outside independent agency recognized my competence and credibility, and therefore the court, we hope, would as well. So I was fortunate enough to spend 4 years cross-designated with IRS criminal investigations when I was working for Indiana State Police and looking at the certifications within IRSCI and working with professional accountants that also were criminal investigators and others, trying to do everything I could working with those colleagues on cases that were leading towards a federal indictment, a federal prosecution, to be able to demonstrate, even outside the court, to demonstrate that federal prosecutor, demonstrate to the state prosecutor, demonstrate to the victim that may be a bank or the victim that might be a construction company that I had that competency with someone in whom they could put their trust to conduct that investigation in a proper way.
So you were cross-designated with the IRS criminal investigation for a couple of years. Where did you learn most dealing with those guys?
I'll tell you, I was fortunate to be in a unique situation where I was assigned for 6 years to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Indiana and then partnered with federal partners on a case-by-case basis based on the nature of the investigation. Many of them were complex fraud investigations or corruption investigations. The reason for that cross-designation was to get access to an ex parte material or Title 26 material, because in many cases, this involved complex 1956, 1957 money laundering matters or tax fraud matters.
When you say ex parte order, you're meaning that it's tax return information.
In many cases, to get access to an individual investigative target's tax information. What I learned in part was just how protected that tax information is by the IRS and just how seriously the federal government, the IRS, the Department of Justice take people's individual privacy, their tax privacy, as well as just how formalized the investigative process is. What I really enjoyed was working with the consummate professionals of IRS criminal investigations. I really enjoyed the environment of physically working at a U.S. Attorney's office every day for 6 years. As a complex investigation was unfolding, working that collaboratively, looking at investigative strategy with a diverse group of investigative efforts and a federal prosecutor that's an expert in the prosecution, and being able to bring victims some sense of justice involving some very complex, very elaborate fraud schemes.
Tell me about a fraud investigation that you were most proud of or made a difference to you.
If we're talking about a fraud investigation makes the most difference, one involves an individual who was at the time convicted federal felon for identity deception. Again, committed identity deception to get access to $11.4 billion of state retirement money, committed identity fraud, and then engaged in various forms of fraud once he got that access. I enjoyed as an investigator doing whodunit investigations. In this case, it wasn't whodunit. It was a matter of can we demonstrate that there was knowledge of guilt, that this is an intentional act on his part? And beyond that, could we basically unravel what amounted to a very complex scheme where he took great steps to obfuscate the crimes that were being committed? And I was very proud that we were able to identify all the crimes that he committed. And ultimately, he pled guilty in federal court and served a sentence of 10 years.
Was he like an insider?
He was. This is an insider fraud. He used the identity of another person so that he portrayed himself as not being a federally convicted felon to get access to the Public Employees Retirement Fund of Indiana.
So what steps did he take to conceal it?
Providing false information on background documents, providing false social security numbers, providing steps within the computer system. Once he understood the specific controls involved, being able to put himself in a position where he could bypass those controls. As an insider, you figure out what the controls are, then you figure out a way around the controls. And that's what he did.
As long as there's human beings, there's always going to be a way to get around things. And evidently, he was very good at it. There's no perfect internal controls for sure.
There is not. Over the course of my career has specifically looked at technology related to fraud and other kinds of crimes, because the lines are blurred quite a bit with what is economic crime fraud, what is cybercrime. The lines are really blurred. No matter how good the technology is, no matter how good the technological controls are, there's always a way around it.
What did you wish you had known when you started your career as an investigator and then later on was as vice president of NW3C?
Couple different things. If you're talking about when I started my police career now over a quarter century ago, I wish I had known how much it would impact my life personally as well as professionally. So those of your listeners to this podcast that work in law enforcement probably know what I'm talking about, where I wish I had known, I likely would have still gotten into law enforcement, but had known exactly what the impact would be with the interactions we have, not just with offenders, but with victims, whether those are fraud victims or violent crime victims, and how that impacts every aspect of our life. I wish I had known that ahead of time. I wish I had known, particularly the fraud investigations, that to be more prepared for, in some cases, the lower sentencing impact of those. One of the things I noticed throughout my fraud career is the victims are suffering injuries. But the problem is, we're talking about fraud, in many cases, these are not visible injuries. When we talk about a violent crime, people can see the black eye. They can see the murder victim. They can see the victimization of a violent sexual assault. But when we're talking about a victim of fraud, in many cases, the consequences for the victims are very significant. Victims that have to declare bankruptcy, where marriages are ruined because of it and the financial loss. Generations of family then don't get to go to college because there's no money to pay for it because they suffer that financial loss. But because you don't see those physical injuries, in many cases, the sentencing impact for those offenders is much lighter. One frustration as a supervisor is we may spend months or in some cases years conducting investigation day-to-day basis. And then the offender is asked to pay back 20% of the money they stole and get a 6-month suspended sentence at the end of that. The frustration that can cause. I think the better we can prepare new fraud investigators for that possible outcome, the less stress it is for those investigators. You know, we can do the best possible investigation we can do as professional, but at the end of the day, we're not responsible for what the sentencing impact of that ultimately is. Those are things that are outside our control. So I wish that I understood that better as a young fraud investigator, something I try to do as a supervisor to prepare new fraud investigators just for that.
Because the sentencing many times does not reflect the skills or the value of the investigation. It's just the way the ball bounces and the way the judge rules. Sometimes you may have a witness that dies on you or something of that nature, and you did all this work. There's this money gone, and a judge rules the way a judge rules. You could spend a couple of years on a fraud case, and an investigator just walks away going, probation? You got to be kidding. I mean, but it has nothing to do with the skills of the investigator. It's just the way the judge at that particular time wanted to rule on the defendant.
The best at fraud investigators are those that become very involved with that investigation, basically invest their heart and soul into it, and very much are empathetic and sympathetic to victims involved in this. And because of that, it can hit an investigator hard when it isn't the same sentencing outcome that investigator was expecting, or when you are trying to track the post-civil lawful activity, you're trying to track the funds, trying to make the victims whole, and the money's just gone. So despite your best efforts, there's nothing you can do to ever, in a financial way, try to make those victims whole or even come close to be whole again.
So true. It's a very good point. As an investigator, get emotionally involved trying to get these victims some type of justice. And at the end of the day, the criminal may get a couple of years in sentencing or maybe 20 years, depending on what went on. But that victim now has lost a lifetime of savings. It's just sad because there's no way you can fix that. You just can't fix it.
And I can think of specific instances where it has cost marriages. The marriage cannot recover. I've seen victims lose homes. People lose their life savings over it. So that was once going to be a comfortable retirement is now being on food assistance. For a investigator that cares, there's a cumulative stress associated with that. I think it really is important for us to make sure that we prepare younger investigators for that so they can better deal with that and better cope with that. I'll tell you also, in many cases, those of us, you, myself, others, we're the ones that are directly talking with the victims. We're the ones that have to answer the question of the victim, why couldn't you get my money back? Why couldn't you save my house? Why didn't this person suffer a penalty for what he did to me and my family or what he did to cause me to lose my business?
Not to say anything bad about prosecutors, defense attorneys, but we spend a lot more time on these witnesses or victims than they ever have. And just because we sit in the houses with them and see the devastation sometimes. Most of the time, prosecutor or defense attorney will see them mostly in court or the judge sees them in court. You don't get the full impact, I don't think, sometimes. A front row view of the devastation of a fraud investigation.
Every much as devastating in some cases as a violent crime.
Oh, absolutely. Because sometimes there's betrayal involved. And that's kind of hard to get over when you've been betrayed by your best friend or your spouse or your employer or et cetera, or maybe the person you went on vacation with for 20 years and you find out that they stole your money later on. And it's just people can't get over that. And it's very difficult.
These people have abused positions of trust. What that means is people trusted them. Is that person ever going to be able to trust someone again? If you look at it, we talk about losing homes and businesses. I've known victims that have committed suicide. Because they couldn't live with that loss of ability to trust.
Who has influenced you the most, aside from your parents, in your career?
The offenders themselves, those that I've investigated, and the victims in those cases have influenced me, influenced my way of thinking, how I look at individuals and how I look at crime. And then also I can think of a particular investigator right now who doesn't do fraud investigations, does another type of investigation, has been working for 41 years in law enforcement. Even with 41 years in law enforcement, when I was his direct supervisor, I would call him on a weekend. One time called him on Christmas Day about an investigation and was anxious to come out and conduct that investigation. Has true empathy for victims, really is trying to make a difference in his community. Both those influences. And it may sound weird, but in some cases I talk about being influenced by the offenders, but also in some ways a positive influence of the offenders that I can look back and say, okay, I did something professionally that I'm proud of.
Have you ever had a offender come back and thank you?
I did when I worked in uniform, because working for Indiana State Police, we also work in uniform. So I did. I when I was arresting people for the kinds of crimes that those of us working in uniform do. Things like domestic violence and drug offenses and others. Yeah, I did have offenders come back and thank me. Had you not arrested me, I probably would have killed my spouse. That's the direction I was going. I probably would have ended up in a drug overdose had that not happened. I'm thinking back, as you mentioned that, about once I started changing my role to more investigations about organized crime, corruption, fraud, and then other kinds of crimes like internet crimes against children. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that there's a time that one of those offenders come back and thank me.
I had a con artist, and he was doing a scheme trying to fraud people out of money. Give me $5,000, I can give you a $100,000 loan. It's called an advance fee scheme. And he was emotionally up and down, up and down, up and down. When I interviewed him and broke the news to him that he's been caught, broke down, of course, and we were just talking to him as a human being to human being. And later on, he told my supervisor, not in a courtroom setting, but maybe in a different setting, that he thanked me just because just being kind to guy helped him stay off the ledge because he was looking at a couple of years and he knew he's going to lose his family, he's going to lose everything. And this is not his first rodeo, it's his second rodeo. It was very nice of him. I had another lady. She was just one of those people that were just probably a good person, but just got caught up in some stupidity. And later on, had to plead guilty and had to pay her sentence, of course. But she came out and she said she was doing fine. She was doing great, learned her lesson, and went on, which is kind of nice.
it's those little things we hold on to.
Looking back in your law enforcement career, what was the biggest mistake or lost opportunity that you have?
It may not be the answer in a fraud podcast. My career as a supervisor involved the Indiana Internet Crimes Control and Task Force. I mean, the commander of that, meaning doing investigation involving those involved unlawfully with child pornography and online child solicitation, sexual extortion. I found doing fraud investigations and particularly corruption investigations to be very rewarding. I found it being rewarding in large part because I was investigating people either thought they were above the law because of their position in society or smarter than the average bear. I found it very rewarding to do those investigations of those kinds of offenders. But had I to do this over again, would have found satisfaction in conducting those Internet Crimes Against Children investigations. I found doing fraud investigations and cybercrime investigations incredibly rewarding, but even more so, in many ways, the same kinds of offenses, the same kinds of fraud, the same kinds of conning people, tricking people, exploiting people, abusing positions of trust. But when we turn to Internet Crimes Against Children, now that victim is a child instead of being an adult. If I had it over again, I would look at doing those exact same investigative skills, many of the exact same investigative techniques, but instead of going looking at offenders that were targeting adults or businesses with financial motive, those offenders that were targeting children with a sexual motive. I would have probably spent more of my career doing Internet Crimes Against Children investigations.
There is a lot of satisfaction, even though it's a dirty world to get into. It emotionally takes a toll on you. I had a chance to work with a FBI agent who was crimes against minors. I've always told her she's my hero. She just is. Just because she's doing it in a messy world and does it well. And I was just proud to be just part of a case with her. And it was, my hat's off to those people doing the type of investigation. And the prosecutors, they really have to do a hard job that, frankly, no one wants to think about from a general public. We know it exists, but we don't want to think about it every single day just because it's so, it takes an emotional toil on it to believe that people actually act like that, abuse children.
What we do as fraud investigators and Internet Crime Control investigators, we try to help, in many cases, people that are not in a position to be able to help themselves.
Yes.
And find justice for those that can't find justice for themselves. So I look at this as a fraud investigator. In many cases, I don't know how you can do this. How can you go and look to the box of bank records?
It's a spiritual gift, Chuck. It's a calling.
It is a calling to sit down in a room full of base-numbered boxes of records.
And get excited.
And get excited about it. Because you get excited about that little thing you find when you found that one electronic communication, the one email. The one message, the one ledger that they didn't want you to find buried in the mountain of other stuff. And this is very similar when I transitioned and was responsible for those that conduct Internet Crimes Against Children investigations, the same thing. How can you do these investigations with these victims? How can you look at these images and see these images? How can you interview these kind of offenders? Why? Because I get the satisfaction out of this person is not going to hurt kids anymore. This child is not going to be abused anymore. I see a lot of parallels.
You ready for the final four questions?
Absolutely.
All right, final four. What is your biggest motivation now, Chuck?
My biggest motivation right now is to spend as much time as I can in retirement with my family and to do it in a way that in my second career, because I really took to heart someone who told me that don't retire from something, retire to something, that as a retired to NW3C, I can still in a small tangential way help keep people safe, help those that are still practitioners catch bad guys. If I can do both those things, I'll be successful in my second career.
I believe that God created us to be productive no matter what stage in life you're in. And even though someone gets a retirement paycheck, they're still required to be productive.
An email I occasionally get from someone saying, hey, so I attended this training and I used that thing I saw on the second day and I caught a bad guy with it. That's very rewarding for me still. So that someone then uses that to catch a bad guy, the next generation, the generation after that uses that information, that's professionally rewarding. If I can do that in a way that I still can be present in my family's lives, that's even more rewarding.
Well, you do a great job at NW3C. Just want to let you know, I've said it at the beginning of the podcast, and I continue to do so. I think you're an excellent speaker, an excellent teacher, and I look forward to see more webinars and more classes that you actually do.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
What books have changed your life or thinking?
When I read as much as possible, have it be a diversion, have it be something different than how I spend my life professionally. But at the same time, I'll tell you one book that comes to mind immediately is a book called American Kingpin that talks about Russ Ulrich and Silk Road, and how Silk Road, which in many ways was the first dark market, first market for people to come together and buy and sell bad things, and that used the Tor network and used cryptocurrency to do that, how that was set up, how that was investigated, and all the nuances of it. I found it to be really well researched based on information I have from other sources about that investigation. It was really interesting from a variety of perspectives as I do training to others, and I research dark nets and dark markets that I point to.
I actually had some questions regarding the whole scheme about how someone could create a database literally to buy, to be an eBay for the dark nets, what it was. That was the same book that was recommended to me, and I got a chance to read it, and you're right, it's a very good book.
If you look at it, what's noticeable and what something else that I've noticed as an investigator to try to train others is we're looking at skilled offenders. And Ross Ulrich clearly was a skilled offender. When we do those investigations, we've got to look at when they're going to make a mistake and find those mistakes they make. They tend to make those mistakes, and it's illustrated in the instance of Silk Road and Ross Ulrich two different times. One, early in their tradecraft, before they got as good as they were towards the end, and two, when they're under stress. So as an investigator, if we can look at that, we find with Ross Ulrich, the two different threads that led to him and ultimately him being identified and arrested and Silk Road being interdicted was one, early in his tradecraft when he used an email address to trickle back to him to basically advertise, hey, there's this new way to buy and sell drugs. Two, when he was moving from one country to another because he thought the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang was going to kill him, whole other part of the story, and he forgot to turn on encryption one time when he logged into a server in Iceland. You know, one, early in his tradecraft, two, under stress. And I found that really informative, and we see it happening over and over again. And I think about that when I was conducting investigations and now when we try technical assistance for investigations to look in those two times. And that's one of the reasons why American Kingpin really resonated with me.
Share something that you have purchased in the last 12 months, less than 100 hours, that you enjoyed or made your job easier.
I won't say I enjoyed it, but the one thing I purchased in $100 that made my life easier was a good mask. You got to find a mask that you like. It's different for everybody, but until we no longer have to wear a mask, but I have had to travel a couple times since March and flying airplanes. And I'll tell you, finding a mask that is comfortable that you can wear for an entire day, that's probably the best thing I've invested in $100 in the last year or last 6 months.
It's like finding a nice pair of gloves or a nice pair of shoes. If you find one that fits, you like it. You want to keep buying them. If you had to do something else, if you were fired today from your job, what would you be doing?
I think I would find a job where either independently or somewhere else I was presenting training. I'm kind of a ham. I like to hear myself talk, as those listening to podcasts may have already figured out. I want to do the best I can to be able to relate my experiences and what hopefully I learned over a quarter century in law enforcement to further generations. So I think I'd go look for another opportunity to be able to present, to provide training to police, prosecutors, analysts, and be able to do as best I possibly could.
You have definitely a heart of a trainer, Chuck, and I do appreciate NW3C and you being out there assisting all the state, local, and federal law enforcement agencies. It's good to see people like you, the organization like you out there. It's been a resource to me, and I just want to say thank you to you and your organizations for doing so.
I appreciate it, and thank you for the podcast you do, because what you're doing also, frankly, is getting information out to those that are interested in fraud investigations, and that's an important thing.
Well, I love it. I love it. Be able to talk to people like you and in the NW3C. But I appreciate your time, Chuck. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
And thank you, Robert.